Well, you ticked off a number of items earlier in the discussion that would seem to indicate you believe that there's going to be another internal crisis not very far down the road for China. Yes?
I think it's a good possibility, particularly because major elements of the military, I think, are still very disaffected. They've lost their economic base. Their companies were taken away from them. They tend to be sitting in the dustbin as everybody else is on the prosperity wagon. Your average soldier, I mean, he's barely getting enough to eat. And in the old days, being a soldier was a respectable job. I mean, you had food, you had some status, you had living quarters, you had medical care. Now, if you're a soldier, people laugh at you and say you must be some kind of dumpkin to have gone into the military. So you get the military very disaffected. And in addition, they've been riffing out a lot of people. I mean, they've had major reductions so that their regular army is down to 2,300,000. So that means 1,200,000 have been shed in the last 7 or 8 years. These are people with, you know, military training. They know how to handle weapons. They know how to, you know, conduct the three-block war, as we say. They know where the weapons are kept. If these people get motivated, such as we saw in the Zhengzhou riots 2 years ago, 100,000 of them could gather in no time with cell phones, text messaging, and things like that. Mm-hmm. China has always been very volatile. And this is one of the strange things here in the West. We tend to have this image of China as a very Pacific country, tea drinking, poetry writing, sitting around admiring the river. And some famous scholars, including John Fairbank at Harvard, who was my advisor, said that, China has no heroes and they have no martial culture. And that is completely and absolutely wrong. I mean, they have all kinds of heroes. And if you want the most recent, of course, it's Bruce Lee and Jet Li. Mm-hmm. They have a martial culture that's second to none. They have a history of warfare that was unremitting and continuous. They have the largest military writings, a huge corpus, 400 books right now that I have in my own personal library that go back to 500 BC. And they have a conscious cultivation of a military ethos that's found among the populace in general. I mean, everybody admires strongmen, and China in particular admires things like assassins. So when we talk about China coming to dominate in 2050, I see two kind of reasons. One is that as their own economy grows very strong, they become self-sufficient. So if you look at the world, it's divided up into, say, four major market areas, North America, Europe, and Southeast Asia, including Africa, and then China. Pretty soon, China will reach the point where if it loses one of the other three, it will be irrelevant. They can afford to antagonize the American market. They can afford to, get in conflict with Americans and not be able to continue to export to America, say, in 10 or 15 years. And at the same time, they are also consciously modeling on the ancient Qin Dynasty case. The state of Qin was the one that's associated with all those wonderful tomb figures and soldiers that you see in Xi'an. The state of Qin was a little peripheral state in the west of China. And early on, it embraced a kind of Spartan military ethos compared to the other six states to the east. And it gradually, through a program of systematic subversion, assassination, bribery, military power, corruption, soft and hard power, displaced and conquered the other six states. And contemporary think tanks looking at that and seeing that as an example is how China today can proceed to end American hegemony in the Pacific and then in the world. And all those elements, particularly bribery and disinformation, et cetera, which make up a kind of unorthodox subversive program, are very much discussed and embraced in their military writings. So they seem to have this plan, and they seem to be willing to take 25 years to get there. The first stage will be to eliminate the United States in the Pacific, and we're already seeing that happen. I mean, in Australia, the United States rating has gone way down. Many Australians will not support the United States if we go to the support of Taiwan. The Australian government has signed a number of agreements to sell uranium and other things to People's Republic of China. And, in fact, People's Republic of China is trying to keep India from being able to buy uranium from Australia right now because they're concerned this is the only power that can be a counterbalance to them, the only threat. And India's population will surpass China's, I think, in 15 years, something like that. And India is you know, building its military with amazing speed. And now that they have nuclear weapons, well, they want to, the Chinese want to keep the Indians from having as many nuclear weapons as they do. Anyway, you see this kind of soft power working in Asia. Countries like the Philippines are now having Chinese taught as a second language in their high schools. Even places like Indonesia, which are very, very anti-Chinese, always have been. I mean, when I've gone into Indonesia, I've had my Chinese books taken away from me at customs and even gotten severe lectures about, you know, this kind of material is extremely evil. All of a sudden, the Indonesians are cozying up to the Chinese and asking for aid and, you know, signing trade deals. So you see this soft power of PRC beginning to be very effective. Only the Japanese are kind of standing off and saying they're very threatening. And that's why the Japanese have been much more open to military alliances and measures with the United States in the last year or so.